And it is indeed the Mideast Migraine Show, weekday edition. It's 3:01 in the afternoon at Free Radio Santa Cruz. No, folks, this is not the Dr. Mike Show. Michael O'Grady and I, Ren Tawil, both happen to really love that piece immensely. It is sung by Andreas Bocelli. I'm always wondering if my pronunciation, Italian pronunciation, is spot on for him, Andrea Bocelli, Conte Partiro. And it just blows me away when I notice that it's from an album dating 1996. I was turned on to that piece only a few years ago. I became aware of it anyway, and probably to this day it's still Bocelli's favorite piece of music. Yes, Bocelli is the blind poet, or the blind singer at any rate. Oh, once again, this is Rent Wheel, and this is the Mideast Migraine Show for Monday, March 2nd. And in the year of our Lord, as it were, 2015. I just realized I mislabeled the recording signature as March 1st, but it's really the second day of March 2015. And it is now 3:07 in the afternoon, and if those figures jive with your personal time-space continuum, then you know that the show is live, and you may call in at any point, preferably to talk about issues pertaining to Israelis and Palestinians and other Middle Eastern items. That really is what the show is about, given the name Mideast Migraines. Okay, here are the phone numbers. Here in Santa Cruz County, California, the west, the central coast of California, area code 831 for both lines, area 831. Line 1 is 427-3772. 427-3772. Line number 2. In case you couldn't figure out how to get through on the first line. Line 2 is 469-3119. Again, 469-3119. They are open. And I want to get to it here. I want to get to the substance of this program. Namely, what's the latest with Israel and Palestine here? Well, first I'm going to have to get to the right folder. How about something along the lines of a public service announcement? This is going to be happening in Menlo Park. Hellfire. Lockheed Martin and the weapons industry go to Gaza. What on earth can that be about? When? Saturday, February 28th. So it's almost... it's already March. I was... Oh, my... Wait a minute. I do apologize, folks. What's going on now is not the usual technical problems. There's just some confusion here. Okay, well, no, I cannot find Saturday the 28th. Okay, please forgive me for not paying closer attention. Apparently, this particular event has passed. So let's just move right along here. I'm sure you'll find this quite interesting. Picked this up 4 or 5 days ago. The tragedy of Elie Wiesel. Why does such a great man keep apologizing for a government that betrays his ideals? By well-known Middle Eastern subjects writer Peter Beinart. Actually dated February 18. The tragedy of Elie Wiesel. Night. The Night, the title of a book from 1972. Let's start once more. Night, which Elie Wiesel wrote in 1955, may have changed the world. The book of his that most changed me was comparatively obscure. It's called Sages and Dreamers, and it is a series of highly personal essays on biblical characters, Talmudic sages, and Hasidic masters that he published in 1991. Until I read it, and again, these are the words of author Peter Beinart here, until Mr. Beinart read it, he had thought of Wiesel primarily as a symbol of Jewish suffering. But when I read Sages and Dreamers, I realized that he was also a tremendous repository of Jewish joy, the joy that comes from deep intimacy with our tradition. Referring, of course, to the Jewish tradition. Author Peter Beinart is Jewish. Reading Sages, referring to the book Sages and Dreamers, reading Sages in my early 20s helped me realize that there are other ways of honoring the memory of the Shoah, which is the Hebrew word for what is more often referred to as the Holocaust, which do not involve monuments or plaques or photographs of emaciated figures behind barbed wire. One of them is by experiencing Jewish joy, by coming close enough to Jewish texts to feel some of the warmth and beauty that radiates through Wiesel's pages. I realize that when Wiesel's brilliance, I realized then that Wiesel's brilliance lay not merely in his ability to convey what Jews endured at Auschwitz, but in his ability to convey the riches that they brought with him, riches that future generations must not squander. I am grateful as a young person to have felt some of Wiesel's greatness, and I am grateful to have been taught at around the same time by Rabbi Arthur Hertzberg that in our tradition, not even the greatest are beyond challenge. In 1988, Hertzberg, himself from a family of survivors, himself a man immersed in Jewish tradition, and himself a passionate Zionist, challenged Wiesel's apologies for Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Noting that Kotzker Rebbe's observation that, and I quote, when the evil one wants to destroy us, he tempts us not through our wicked desires, but through our most virtuous inclinations, Hertzberg argued that Wiesel's laudable desire to believe the best about the Jewish people and the Jewish state was blinding him to the Jewish capacity for evil. Almost three decades later, sadly, it still is. Last week, the New York Times and Washington Post ran an open letter by Wiesel supporting Benjamin Netanyahu's forthcoming speech to Congress that, by the way, is scheduled for tomorrow, March 3rd. In it, Wiesel makes two assertions, neither of which he makes any effort to prove. The first is that the United States and Iran are on the verge of, quote, a terrible deal. What makes the deal, which has not even been struck, terrible, Wiesel doesn't say. The second is that a nuclear Iran would likely mean, and I quote again, the annihilation and destruction of Israel, end quote. Incidentally, the clause, the annihilation and destruction, itself is in subquotes, the annihilation and destruction of Israel. This, too, requires evidence that Wiesel does not provide. After all, Benny Gantz, who just retired as chief of staff of the Israel Defense Forces, has argued that while an Iranian nuke would be dangerous, Gon says here, the Iranian leadership is composed of very rational people. That's an Israeli speaking there, the former head of the IDF. The Iranian leadership is composed of very rational people. One of his predecessors in that job, Dan Halutz, has said that Iran poses a serious threat, but not an existential one. Earlier this month, a former Mossad head, Ephraim Halevi, added that, I think it is a terrible mistake to use the term existential threat because I do not believe there is an existential threat to Israel. Current Mossad head, Tamir Pardo, has also warned that, quote, the term existential threat is used too freely. For years now, Israeli security officials have debated the nature of the Iranian nuclear threat. Wiesel, however, does not debate. He simply asserts. But the deeper problem with Wiesel's letter is the one Hertzberg identified three decades ago. Wiesel is acutely and understandably sensitive to the harm Jews suffer. Yet he is largely blind to the harm Jews cause. In his open letter, Wiesel notes that the Iranian threat is particularly vivid now because Jews will soon celebrate Purim when they read about, quote, a wicked man in Persia named Haman who tried to, quote, annihilate, murder, and destroy the Jews. But on Purim, Jews also read about what happens after Haman's fall from power when Persia's Jews, and I quote, with the stroke of the sword and slaughter and destruction, slew of their foes 75,000, referring to Persia's Jews, with the stroke of the sword and slaughter and destruction, slew of their foes 75,000. If the book of Esther in the Old Testament, in Christian parlance, offers a haunting warning of the violence Jews can suffer, why does it not also warn us of the violence Jews can inflict? And if Wiesel is so alarmed by threats of nuclear annihilation, why does he keep embracing his former patron, Sheldon Adelson, who in 2013 urged the United States to drop an atomic weapon, quote-unquote, in the Iranian desert, and then, if the Iranians don't halt their nuclear program, drop one, quote, in the middle of Tehran. That's the capital city of Iran. So the Iranians are, quote, wiped out. This tendency to whitewash Jewish behavior is a feature of Wiesel's previous statements on Israel, too. In 2010, when the Obama and Netanyahu governments tussled over settlement growth in East Jerusalem, Wiesel wrote a public letter celebrating Jewish control over Jerusalem because, quote, for the first time in history, Jews, Christians, and Muslims all may freely worship at their shrines. And contrary to certain media reports, Jews, Christians, and Muslims are allowed to build their homes anywhere in the city, end quote. Wiesel's motivations for believing the best about Jewish control of the holy city may have been commendable, but his claims were blatantly untrue. In a detailed rebuttal, Daniel Seidemann, a lawyer specializing in Jerusalem land claims, noted that one-third of East Jerusalem and almost all of West Jerusalem is, quote, state land, available for residence only to Israeli citizens and diaspora Jews eligible to become Israeli citizens. And since the Palestinians of East Jerusalem, with rare exception, are in neither of these categories, Wiesel may purchase a home anywhere in East or West Jerusalem, but a Palestinian cannot. Seidemann also dismantled Wiesel's claims about religious access, noting that due to Israeli restrictions, today it is easier for a Palestinian Christian living just south of Jerusalem in Bethlehem to worship in Washington's National Cathedral than to pray in Jerusalem's Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Today, a Muslim living in Turkey has a better chance of getting to Jerusalem to pray at the old city's Al-Aqsa Mosque than a Muslim living a few miles away in Ramallah. Ramallah, of course, being a major city in occupied West Bank Palestine. Continuing here. Again and again, Wiesel takes refuge in the Israel of his imagination, using it to block out the painful reckoning that might come from scrutinizing Israel as it actually is. I can't believe that Israeli soldiers murdered people or shot children. It just can't be, Wiesel said in 2010, which incidentally was 2 years after Cast led the first of Israel's three major full-fledged assaults on the Gaza Strip. Continuing. But these are not questions of faith. Israel is a decent country composed of decent young men and women who, in the West Bank, are obliged to police people who lack basic rights. And in such circumstances, decent people do indecent things. We are making the lives of millions unbearable, declares one former Shin Bet head, Carmi Gilon, in the film The Gatekeepers. In the West Bank, Israel has become, quote, a brutal occupation force, notes another, Avraham Shalom. A third, Yuval Adiskin, calls the occupation a colonial regime. These men don't hate Israel. They have dedicated their lives to protecting it. But unlike Wiesel, they are discussing the real Israel, not the one they have constructed in their minds. Why is Elie Wiesel, one of the world's great champions of human rights, denying the human rights abuses to which even Israel's own former Shin Bet chiefs have testified? Because the occupation, Israel's control for almost 50 years of millions of human beings who lack the basic rights proclaimed by its own by Israel's own Declaration of Independence, strains everything it touches, not only in Israel, but across the Jewish world. It turns organizations founded to fight bigotry into apologists for it. It forces rabbis to choose between obeying their conscience and keeping their job. Leads Gentiles of goodwill to fear that if they criticize Israel, they'll be called anti-Semites. And in an inversion worthy of the Kotzke Rebbe, it turns Elie Wiesel's great love of the Jewish people and the Jewish state into public relations for a prime minister whose policies defile the ideals Wiesel has spent his life championing. You belong among those who speak the truth, even to Jewish power, wrote Hertzberg. More than a quarter century later, Elie Wiesel still does. Were he to speak forcefully about the injustice Israel is perpetrating in the West Bank, many others would find their voice. On moral questions, Elie Wiesel speaks louder than any Jew alive, which makes his silence loudest, too. There is a note here following the text of this essay. After this piece first appeared on the internet, it was brought to my attention that in 2009, the regulations that legally barred Palestinian residents from purchasing an apartment on, quote, state lands were quietly lifted. In practice, however, it remains extremely difficult for Palestinians to buy homes in Jerusalem's Jewish neighborhoods, and the numbers who have done so are minuscule. So here, Peter Beinart has made the inappropriate correction. If anyone else has any further corrections or comments on this article, I'm not quite sure. In fact, I'm not sure at all who printed it. It simply appears on the internet here. Give me a call at area code 831-427-3772 or on line 2 at 469-3119. I thank everyone who is joining me. now here at 3:25 in the afternoon, this Monday, March 2nd. Let's move along to this item, which I have already presented a week or two ago on one of my previous shows, anyway. That's, whoops. I only need to find a readable version here. Okay, given the fact that tomorrow, the third day of March, is the scheduled, so far as I know, still the scheduled date for Benjamin Netanyahu's speech to Congress, which was called for by the Republican Majority Leader John Boehner, the action of which has been described by someone in the Obama administration as a slap in the face to our president. And Netanyahu did fly in yesterday, so he's in Washington now. As I said, I want to repeat this article, which I read from a previous show, given those facts. The fact that he's here and he wants to talk. He wants to talk at Congress and at the American people here. This is actually from the Washington Post, February 20. It was written by Rebecca Vilcomerson, who is the executive director of Jewish Voice for Peace. In the Washington Post religion section, Netanyahu does not speak for all American Jews. Indeed, it is a commentary by Vilcomerson here. Israeli Prime Minister, and remember, this was posted February 20, a good 10 days ago. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is facing unexpectedly strong pressure to withdraw from a planned March 3 speech to a joint session of Congress. The invitation from House Speaker John Boehner bypassed President Obama entirely. Intended to sway U.S. policy on Iran and support Netanyahu's re-election bid, the invitation is eliciting unprecedented opposition. Netanyahu, in defending the visit, has indicated that he is coming to Congress to speak as a representative of the, and I quote, entire Jewish people. American Jews are largely appalled by the notion that Netanyahu or any other Israeli politician, one that we did not elect and do not choose to be represented by, claims to speak for us. The math is clear. While 69% of American Jews, a population of 6.8 million, and that would be all American Jews, population 6.8 million, 69% of them voted for President Obama in 2012. That his last election, only 23% of Israel's Jews, population 6.1 million, voted for Netanyahu. 69% of American Jews for Obama, 23% of Israel's Jews for Netanyahu. This isn't the first time that Netanyahu has claimed the mantle of the representative of the Jews, nor is it the first time that Jews around the world have been affronted by the idea that the Prime Minister of Israel would claim to speak for them. What makes this moment unique, however, is the unprecedented cracks in the bipartisan consensus that usually sustains unquestioning support of Israel, for Israel. Thus far, at least 25 members of Congress, this being 10 days ago, have publicly pledged to skip Netanyahu's speech, 25, including the heads of the Congressional Black Caucus and the Congressional Progressive Caucus. Staunch Israel supporters, from Thomas Friedman to Jeffrey Goldberg, have expressed concern that the current brouhaha threatens the bipartisan consensus on Israel, while even the leaders of the Anti-Defamation League and the Union for Reform Judaism have called on Netanyahu to cancel his speech. For years, some political observers have noted that there is an alliance of true belief between the Republican Party and the Likud-led Israeli government. While Democratic Party principles should at least, in theory, require some criticism of Israel's settlement building, human rights violations, and discriminatory policies. Of course, it hasn't until now played out that way, as the pressure from donors and the skillful Israel lobby has enforced a virtual, if superficial, consensus on Israel. Now, under the guise of supporting Obama and inter-party wrangling, some Democrats have the opportunity to express a little of their deep anger, not only toward Israeli policies, but their perception that they've been forced to support those policies even when they didn't agree with them to ensure their re-election. This partisan split is why staunch supporters of the Israeli status quo want Netanyahu to cancel the speech. They fear this initial crack in the consensus could lead to a permanent split, with Israel becoming a partisan issue. While coverage of the controversy over the speech has focused on violations of diplomatic protocol and Israeli officials attempting to play Democrats and Republicans against one another, the stakes are actually much higher. Netanyahu is not only trying to dictate American policy toward Iran, but is also using the issue of Iran as a way to avoid hard questions about Israel's policies toward Palestinians and its own citizens. The current controversy around Netanyahu's speech has revealed that we have known for a long time, that the increasingly oppressive and hawkish policies of the Israeli government do not reflect the values of American Jews, nor of Democrats. Israel's right-wing leadership, which justified a brutal war against Gaza last summer, continues settlement construction in the face of international censure and allows ongoing attacks in the streets of Israel against Palestinians and anti-war activists, is not worthy of our support. The long-standing bipartisan support for Israel, even as it continues to flout international law and undermine the possibility for peace, has long been an anomaly in U.S. politics. That's why those of us who have long advocated change in U.S. policy towards Israel see the growing backlash against the speech as a hopeful sign. A couple of weeks ago, Jewish Voice for Peace and a coalition of allies initiated an online campaign to ask our elected officials to ?skip the speech. I suspect she means ?skip the speech, but I don't know how all those weird typewriter keys play into whichever social media program you're using. At any rate, a couple of weeks ago, Jewish Voice for Peace and Coalition of Our Allies initiated an online campaign to ask our elected officials to ?skip the speech as a strong statement against warmongering and electioneering. Over 55,000 people have since taken action. Other progressive groups have issued similar calls. Trends indicate a powerful discomfort with Israeli actions among many Americans, including people of color and young Jews. A growing discomfort with Israeli actions. Elected Democratic officials may increasingly find support among their base for taking a clear stand against warmongering and Israel's assumed unconditional support by the United States. Skipping the speech is turning out not just to be good policy, but good politics. That online article from February 20's Washington Post. Commentary by Rebecca Vilcomerson, who is the executive director of Jewish Voice for Peace, JVP, the largest grassroots Jewish organization working for equality and human rights for all the people of Israel and Palestine. For copyright information, please check with the distributor of this item, Religion News Service, Limited Liability Corporation. Okay. That's all on this item. Having read it, on a previous program, I probably, yeah, it seems to me I went ahead and read internet comments about this. You'll have to go to my archives to a week or two ago, Monday program, as opposed to the Saturday edition of Mideast Migraines. One of my previous Monday's programs. If you want to hear those internet comments, or simply go to the Washington Post in their religion section under February 20. Okay, and it's 3:36 p.m. You have heard about the tragedy of Elie Wiesel, according to Peter Beinart, and Rebecca Vlachomerson's commentary on Netanyahu not speaking for all Americans. Now, I want to give you an opportunity to hear from a former member of the American Israel Political Action Committee, who quit AIPAC in disillusionment. But first, let's have a little more music.
Vivo ricopiando yesterday. E sono sempre in mezzo ai guai. Vivo e ti domando cosa sei. Ma specchio, tu non parli mai. Io che non potrò mai creare niente. Io amo l'amore, ma non la gente. Io non sarò mai un dio. Vivere nessuno mai ce l'ha insegnato. Vivere fotocopiandoci il passato.
Se tu vedessi l'uomo davanti al tuo portone, che dorme avvolto in un cartone. Se tu ascoltassi il mondo una mattina, senza il rumore della pioggia. Tu che puoi creare con la tua voce. Pensi pensieri della gente, poi di Dio c'è solo Dio. Vivere, nessuno mai ce l'ha insegnato. Vivere, non si può vivere senza passato. Vivere, è bello anche se non l'hai chiesto mai. Ci sarà sempre qualcuno che la canterà.
Qualcuno non mi basta vivere, cercando ancora il grande amore. Vivere come se mai dovessimo morire. Vivere per poi capire all'improvviso che in fondo questa vita tu non l'hai vissuta. Vivere,
voglia di vivere.
Once again, you heard the voices of Andrea Bocelli on this particular track, also featured Andrea Bocelli featuring Geraldina Trovato. And I'm sure she's famous and wonderful. Vivere, from the same album that we first that we heard Conte Partiro at the beginning of the program on. This was Vivere. And the name of this 1996 Insieme album. Insieme is the owner, anyway. Netherlands production company. The name of the album is Romanza. Romanza, starring Andrea Bocelli. Italian. Well, certainly a popular singer. I'm sure he must do certain operatic numbers as well. Okay, folks, here it is. Now, brief explanation here. You're about to hear an interview with one Richard Forer. This is brought to us by Katie Miranda, from whom I have managed to acquire a number of interviews, as a few months ago she introduced the Palestine Telesummit Solidarity schedule of interviews with a bunch of people, including one or two that I know personally. Katie Miranda and her Palestine Telesummit Solidarity internet offering. This one specifically, Miranda says, this is a Press TV interview with Richard Forer. She says, I love transformation stories like Richard's. He was a former member of AIPAC, again, American Israel Public Affairs Committee, who had a spiritual awakening which led him to become a staunch supporter of Palestinian rights. He talks about how the roots of his irrational fears of the Arab world were based on indoctrination that all Arabs want to kill all Jews. And Katie puts a couple of exclamation points after that in parentheses. She says, knowledge is power, and this is a must-listen interview for anyone wanting to understand the Zionist mindset. Their beliefs surrounding the innocence of Israel are so hard to break because they form core parts of their identity. She also notes down here, if you're familiar with the root causes of apartheid in South Africa, you will instantly recognize the similar mindset held by Zionists and Afrikaners, white South Africans. In solidarity, Katie Miranda, Portland, Oregon. Now, everyone keep your fingers crossed, because I tried playing this last week, and I ended up overlapping one browser function over another, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. Here is the interview with Richard Forer, the author of Breakthrough and The Autograph. Date given is September 28, 2011. Identity here given is PressTV.ir, www.PressTV.ir.
Welcome to The Autograph with me, Susan Medeiros. This week, I am joined by Richard Forer from Albuquerque, New Mexico. He's joining me to talk about his book, Breakthrough. We also have a lot to discuss regarding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, so do join us.
After more than 60 years, the Israeli-Palestinian issue is as intractable as ever. Groups and individuals on either side reflexively point to the other as the cause of conflict. Throughout most of his life, Richard Forer has been a loyal defender of Israel and zealously supported Israel's 2006 invasion of Lebanon. In response to what he perceived as growing global anti-Semitism, he became a member of AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. Angry that two of his most trusted friends resisted his views, and surprised that a longtime Jewish friend would suggest that his opinions were not as factually based as he assumed, Forer began an intensive study of the history of the Israel-Palestine conflict, determined to discover the facts for himself. With an uncompromising commitment to the truth, he went far beyond his original intention, even challenging his very identity, which ultimately led to a transformation of his beliefs. In Breakthrough, Transforming Fear into Compassion, Forer tells his story and presents historical facts that support his arguments. Richard Forer, welcome to The Autograph. You know, you've had a very interesting journey. Tell us about that, and why did your views drastically change in regard to the Israeli-Palestinian issue?
Well, my journey was that, first of all, I'm Jewish, and I grew up on the East Coast in the United States, and I grew up during I grew up in the 50s, and that was, you know, very soon after the Holocaust had ended. And Israel, of course, was a safe haven for the Jewish people. It was the place, the one place in the world where my people could be free from persecution and death. And so growing up in that atmosphere, I naturally believed that Israel was a benign country that simply wanted to live in peace with its neighbors, with its Arab neighbors. And I believed this my entire life. And what happened, though, to stimulate my change in consciousness is that in 2006, as I'm sure you'll remember, Hamas captured Gilad Shalit, the Israeli soldier, on the Gaza border. 3 weeks later, Hezbollah conducted a cross-border raid into northern Israel from Lebanon and killed, I think, two Israeli soldiers and captured two. And then the next day, Israel launched their invasion of Lebanon, which displaced over 1 million people and killed, I think, about 1,300 people. When Israel launched this invasion of Lebanon, I was all for it. And the combination of Hamas capturing an Israeli soldier in Gaza and Hezbollah killing and capturing Israeli soldiers in northern Israel convinced me, or I should say reinforced my belief and really brought out the fear that the Arab world was never going to make peace with Israel, that they just had so much hatred, pathological hatred, that they would not rest until Israel was destroyed. So I was very, very supportive of Israel's operation in Lebanon. When friends of mine who are not Jewish, but very wise friends of mine, were complaining that Israel was using disproportionate force, I disagreed. I said they had to use the force because they had to destroy Hezbollah, and that Hezbollah had, it just came to me that Hezbollah had embedded its soldiers in civilian populations, which I found out was not true. But I was able to rationalize any action on the part of Israel. Then what happened was, through a series of incidents, mainly speaking to a Jewish friend who was rather neutral, but very, very non-judgmental of my somewhat hysterical attitude, I decided to read some books. And he had suggested books by Israeli Jewish scholars. So I went to the library, my local library, and I picked out a few books by one by an Israeli Jewish scholar and another by a Jewish American scholar, and I started reading. And what I discovered in reading was so contrary to what I believed that while I was reading, I kind of went into shock. I was reading about all these violations of international law, Israel's use of lethal force, even when it was unwarranted, when there was no threat from the other side, Israel's collective punishment of the Palestinian people, its demolition of many, many homes of innocent people, just because maybe a cousin had thrown a rock or had spoken out against the Israeli occupation. And I was reading this information, and at a certain point, I decided to put the book down, to take a rest. It was like overwhelming me. And when I put the book down, I kind of drifted off into a space of nothingness. And I'm saying this in retrospect, because when I drifted into the space of what I call nothingness, I wasn't there. There was no separate awareness of that state of nothingness. But at a certain point, I came out and was conscious of my surroundings. And the first thing I probably noticed was that I felt cleansed of all negative emotions. And I realized that in reading, just before I went into this space of nothingness, I had gone through shock at what I was learning about Israel, anger at Israel for what they were doing to an indigenous people, anger at myself for not having really paid attention over the years to what was really going on, sorrow for the suffering of the Palestinian people, embarrassment and shame at my ignorance. And this is what I all discovered when I came out of this nothingness. And then I noticed I could not find a Jewish identity. And I thought that was remarkable, because if I wasn't going to have a Jewish identity, if somehow this Jewish identity was going to dissolve or vanish, I would have thought that there would be some rather dramatic repercussions, or emotional repercussions, with this dissolution of a core identity. But there was no dissolution, and the Jewish identity simply wasn't there. And then I realized that I was as much Palestinian as Israeli, as much Muslim or Christian as Jew. And then I saw that there was no fear, that I had been my life, my attitude towards the Arab world had been infected by irrational fear, which was based on the indoctrination that the Arabs wanted to kill the Jews, and that Israel was an unwanted country in the midst of a hostile environment. And so this was rather remarkable. And in noticing that I was as much Palestinian as Israeli, as much Muslim or Christian as Jew, I recognized that we are all one being.
Today, the call for an end to occupation, the halt of settlement activities, and the establishment of a Palestinian state is louder than ever. However, I continue our discussion by asking Richard Foer about the role racism and nationalism has played throughout the years as a byproduct of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
The bottom line is that there will be no peace until we are individually and collectively, but it starts with the individual, until we take responsibility for our beliefs by finding out if they really are grounded in actual events or if they are just indoctrinated propaganda that we have absorbed in our society or through our religion, or that we have just taken for granted as being true because someone told us and it turns out not to be true. And also the other element, besides taking responsibility for our beliefs, is recognizing that no one people, no one person is superior to anybody else, and that no matter how much we like or dislike someone, everybody is entitled to the same self-determination as anyone else. And until we care about both sides equally, not that we have to like the other side, but recognize and acknowledge that we're all entitled to this same self-determination, there can be no peace.
In Breakthrough, Foer argues that the true root of conflict is one's presumed identity and the beliefs and images that emanate and reinforce that identity. He writes that these presumptions are false and unnecessary. Blame and intense emotion permeate virtually any discussion of the subject.
So here's my question. Why is it so difficult to have an open, sometimes critical conversation about Israel's policies here in the United States?
The reason it's so difficult for Jewish Americans in our society is because of the fear of the Holocaust, instilled in our minds from childhood, at least in my mind and the Jews of my generation, was the fear that the Arabs represented another threat to the Jewish people. After Adolf Hitler killed 6 million Jews, David Ben-Gurion, Israel's prime minister, the first prime minister of Israel, called Nasser, who was the head of Egypt, and he was the most charismatic figure in the Arab world, he referred to Nasser as the Hitler of the Middle East. Now, this phrase reverberated throughout the Jewish world and convinced Jews that Israel's neighbors, its Arab neighbors, were more interested in igniting another genocide than in making peace. So this contributed to our indoctrination. And what's so difficult is that our beliefs about the Arab world, our beliefs about the innocence of Israel, our belief about the world wanting to destroy the Jewish people to finish what Adolf Hitler started. Those beliefs are part of our identity, our mortal identity. Now, I say that that identity is a presumption. It's a mental construct that is really an illusion. And the reason it's an illusion is because it's so limited. It's not really who we are. And it consists of our acceptance of certain beliefs and images that we take for granted. But because these beliefs and images are part of our identity, the fear of another Holocaust, the fear that the world doesn't care about Israel, that Israel has always been a victim, and that the world wants to continue making Israel a victim, that being part of our mortal identity, letting go of that is equivalent to dying. And really, Susan, it's similar to, people probably will get mad at me for saying this, but it's very similar to the beliefs of Americans. In 2003, when the United States was about to invade Iraq, there were a few voices that spoke out against the invasion, and they were accused of being anti-American and unpatriotic. And what was going on was people, because of their indoctrination into the fear of the other, into the fear of Saddam Hussein or the Arab world or terrorists, because of that indoctrination and the further indoctrination that the United States always stands for freedom for all people and peace, those images, of those patriotic images were more precious to individuals, to most individuals in this country, than the lives of their own children. They were willing to send their children off to Iraq to kill and be killed because they were supporting and maintaining these images, these patriotic images that include the Arab world, or Iraq in this case, as being an enemy that must be extinguished. So it's really a very deep-seated issue. It is the deepest seated issue because it is our identity that we're talking about. It is a spiritual problem.
Through extensive scholarly research, Forer learned that Israel's preemptive attacks on Egypt, Syria, and Jordan in the year 1967 were based on a falsehood that they would have attacked Israel. However, he also came across more shocking historical discrepancies that he tells his readers about.
Well, I guess I could start with the idea that many Jews supported Zionism. Zionism was not supported by most Jews. It was only a small minority that supported the Zionist movement. But because of Zionist organizations in the United States, which prevented President Roosevelt from taking in, President Roosevelt on behalf of the United States as well as Western Europe, from taking in most of the displaced persons, Jewish people, following the Holocaust, these Jews were forced to go to Israel because they couldn't go to the United States or England or France. So Zionism was not something that the Jewish people embraced to any large extent. The next thing that I guess I would discuss is that, yes, of course there was hatred or anger in the Arab world towards the establishment of the State of Israel, but the fact is that beginning in 1948 with Syria and continuing with Nasser for many years in the late 40s, and Nasser was in beginning in 1952, but Nasser from 52 till his death, actually, the Arab world made overtures towards Israel to make peace, and Israel rejected these overtures. And Israel made it clear, like, for example, one of the arguments you hear in our society that justifies the Israeli occupation and justifies Israel's innocence is that Israel accepted the 1947 UN partition plan and the Palestinians rejected it. Well, the truth of the matter is that this partition plan was adopted by the United Nations without asking for the consent of the indigenous people, number one. Number two, it gave 56% of British Mandate Palestine to the Jewish people, who owned less than 7% of the land. And it gave 46% to the Palestinians, with the remaining 1% Jerusalem and Bethlehem under the authority of the United Nations. But the assumption in the argument that people make that Israel accepted and Palestinians rejected this, the assumption they make is that Israel would have been content with 56% of British Mandate Palestine. Well, we know that for a fact, for a documented fact, that Israel has never been content with the 78% of historic Palestine that it has controlled since 1949. And then we know from the Israeli archives that David Ben-Gurion and his political party, Yigal Allon, the most prominent general of the 1948 war, and pretty much the entire Israeli establishment, made it very clear that their acceptance of this partition plan was simply a tactical decision and a prelude to further expansion.
And Richard, can you also tell us about your trip to the West Bank and what you encountered when arriving there?
Well, the first thing I would say is that every Palestinian I encountered, I told them immediately that I was Jewish. And not one Palestinian batted an eye. Every one of them said, the problem is not religion, the problem is not Judaism, the problem is Zionism. We just want to live in peace. But the other things I encountered were the kindness of the Palestinian people, their openness, their connection to the land. They're no different than anybody else. If people would only go to the West Bank, they would see the conditions these people are living in. They would see that they don't get much water, that there might be days when they get no water at all, while their Jewish neighbors in settlements on their land receive water all the time, have swimming pools for their kids, green lawns. You know, the disparity is just very unfair. It's just so unfair, and you see this. And you immediately will know that how can the people live like this? If you put yourself in their place and say, would I be willing to accept a state of being where my neighbors can keep taking the water that belongs to me, where I don't have enough water for my kids to drink, where we don't have electricity often, where I can't send my kids to school. If the school's 10 miles away, it might take them 3 hours to get there because of all the unnecessary checkpoints and the separation wall. I mean, you see all this in real life, and you realize that people are people, and that any human being who is treated like a subhuman is going to respond with, if not violence, at least they're going to respond with despair and anger. And most Palestinians have responded with, in their despair, have responded with nonviolent resistance. Nonviolent resistance has been the major action of the Palestinian people for over 60 years.
Following the 1948 and 1967 wars, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians fled their homes, and both out of fear and because of Israeli force. In 1950, the UN Relief and Works Agency recorded almost 1 million refugees in what is now the West Bank and Gaza Strip, as well as Jordan, Lebanon, and Syria. Today, there are more than 4.5 million refugees in the region, and almost 1.5 million of those refugees remain in UN-run refugee camps. Palestinians continue to call on the right of return to their homes. You know, I also want to talk a bit about the issue of Palestinian refugees and their return status, which is a topic often not discussed. Why is the right to return for Palestinian refugees such a vital point in brokering a peace deal between the two sides?
You know, if Israel is a democratic state for all of its people, and 20% are Arab, of Arab extraction, if Israel really is a democratic state, then it is not acting democratically when it has a law of return for any Jew in the world to come to Israel, but almost no Palestinian or Arab can move to Israel. I mean, I can move to Israel, and I can move into a house on land built on Palestinian territory that was just stolen from Palestinians, but a Palestinian family that has hundreds of years rooted into that land cannot go to that same place as I can. And that is just wrong. And if Israel is going to be a democracy, then all of its citizens should have equal rights. And I'm saying this whether there eventually is a two-state solution, an Israeli and a Palestinian state living side by side, or a one-state solution. In either case, the Palestinians have a right to return, and whether they use it or not is up to them.
And finally, what is the underlying message of your book, and what will your readers take away with them?
Two things. One thing is you have to find out for yourself what the real history is. You can't rely on the establishment to tell us what is going on, or especially our leaders and congressmen and senators, Knesset members, whatever it is. You have to find out for yourself by doing honest, objective research. And then you have to recognize that everybody has the same right to self-determination as everybody else, and that one's religion or nationality does not give them human rights that other people should be denied. And once you realize that, you'll start developing compassion for people. And when you develop compassion, you'll develop some clarity, because in your compassion, you'll be able to see from the point of view of the other. And you'll start seeing that he is no different than you, that he has the same needs as we all have, including the right to freedom, self-determination, and the right to a future for him or herself and their children. I hope that that is the message that people will take away from my book.
Richard Forer from Albuquerque, New Mexico, thank you so much for joining us here on The Autograph, and we hope to see you again very soon on our show.
Thank you very much, Susan. It's been a pleasure being with you.
And that's it from us here in New York City. Thank you so much for watching. Remember, you can always send us your emails to theautograph@susanmodaris.com. We're always looking forward to them. You can also follow me on Twitter for latest updates and discussions. Until next time in another show, goodbye.
And you were listening to Press TV's The Autograph with Susan, I forget her last name now. Interviewing Richard Forer, I'm juggling browsers here, trying to see where I've... Oh, that's all I needed. Yes, again, that was an interview with former member of AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, which is the essentially... It comes down... AIPAC comes down to being the Israel lobby in Washington, D.C., compared by many to the National Rifle Association in its power and ability to intimidate your elected officials in Congress and even our president. And, come on, where are you, honey? Just looking at this, And again, this was brought to us by Katie Miranda's Palestine Telesummit Solidarity Internet activity that she began to bring to us late last year. And there are, you know, she slammed together in rather astonishing speed a series of interviews with important people, Americans, Jew and non-Jew alike, and some Israelis even, and interviewed them. And she, the steam kind of ran out of that activity, unsurprisingly, considering how that she was actually presenting one interview a day for a couple of weeks there, 2 or 3 weeks. Now they come out very slowly, but she's still active. Katie is. Okay. For more information, go to katiemiranda.com. K-A-T-I-E, Miranda is M-I-R-A-N-D-A, katiemiranda.com. You can also go to If Americans Knew for concurrent information. Now, I want to stay in tune with some of the things that the interviewee, Mr. Forer, was talking about. With this item that I picked up recently, this is from The Nation. Aha, of all publications, the American magazine The Nation, investigating progress daily. February 23rd, Netanyahu's latest falsehood. The U.S. didn't support the establishment of Israel. According to Benjamin Netanyahu, he wants people to believe that the U.S. did not support the establishment of Israel. Is Netanyahu's latest falsehood. Benjamin Netanyahu's new campaign ad, his political campaign ad for re-election, rewrites history. By John B. Judas. Spelled J-U-D-I-S. February 23rd, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has attempted to make light of his rift with the Obama administration in a new advertisement that rewrites American-Israeli history. The ad opens with 1948, emblazoned on a black background, and shifts to a photograph of David Ben-Gurion declaring Israeli statehood on May 15, 1948. The text, appearing in Hebrew, reads, 1948, a Ben-Gurion faces a crucial decision, establishment of the State of Israel. The American Secretary of State strongly opposed. Ben-Gurion, contrary to the position of the American State Department, declares the establishment of the State of Israel. Would we be here today if Ben-Gurion hadn't done the right thing? Only the Likud, only Netanyahu. Likud, of course, refers to Benjamin Netanyahu's political party in coalition control with at least one other political party in Jerusalem at the moment, control of Israel. Continuing, here are the facts. The American Secretary of State was George Marshall. In the fall of 1947, when the question of a Jewish and Arab state came before the United Nations, Marshall and President Harry Truman backed the creation of a partition in Palestine between a Jewish and Arab state. Truman and Marshall did attempt at one point to create boundaries that were more equitable. The final proposal had the Jews, who were less than one-third of the population, being granted 56% of the land, just over half, but backed off when the crucial vote on partition came in November. The administration backed and energetically, to say the least, lobbied to gain the necessary two-thirds support for partition, on which the Israelis still base their claim of legitimacy. The resolution would not have passed without American support. Between November and May of 1948, Secretary of State Marshall was preoccupied with the Berlin crisis and left decisions of Palestine to subordinates. In the spring of 1948, with war raging in Palestine, the State Department broached a plan with Truman's support for creating a transition period in Palestine after Britain's departure in May so that the Jews and Arabs might come to some agreement. But they abandoned that effort in the face of opposition from the Jewish leadership in Palestine and from the American Zionist lobby. From that time, in early May, the question was not whether to recognize a new Jewish state, which was expected to be announced on May 15th, but when to do so. Truman's aides, Clark Clifford and David Niles, advocated that before, in italics here, before David Gurion announced a new state, Truman announced that the United States would recognize the new state. They wanted to prevent nationwide demonstrations scheduled for May 14 by the American Zionist Emergency Council from turning into anti-Truman rallies. But Marshall strenuously objected to what would have been an unprecedented diplomatic procedure, which he correctly attributed to the interjection of domestic politics into international relations. That was the issue between him and Clark Clifford, during a climactic May 12 meeting at the White House. After the meeting, Clifford backed down and, with Truman's support, negotiated a plan with the State Department for the United States to recognize the new State of Israel minutes after Ben-Gurion's announcement. I'll read that again. After the meeting, Clifford backed down and, with Truman's support, negotiated a plan with the State Department for the United States to recognize the new state of Israel minutes after Ben-Gurion's announcement. Marshall agreed to this plan. He did not oppose recognition of Israel. Now, and it can be added that from that time to through the spring of last year, the United States has provided Israel, this is since 1948, the U.S. has provided Israel with $121 billion of foreign and chiefly military aid, and supported Israel in its conflicts with Arab states, most critically in 1973 and at the United Nations. I'll leave it to counterfactual historians to decide what exactly would have happened to Israel if the United States had not supported it over the last seven decades. But I think it's pretty clear that contrary to Netanyahu's insinuation, Israel would have had a much more difficult time enduring and becoming prosperous, as well as maintaining an occupation of Palestinian lands without American support. Netanyahu has gotten himself in dangerous waters by attempting to deny this. Again, this article by John B. Judas. More details at thenation.discus.com. That's the, T-H-E, hyphen, nation, dot, D-I-S-Q-U-S, dot com. Thenation.discus.com. That's your approach to the nation's online service. And let me just chime in here. I make absolutely no apology whatsoever for relying so heavily on the internet, and in particular, internet versions of publications, periodicals, magazines, etc., that formerly, of course, up until 20-odd years ago, could not be found on the internet because there was, by and large, no internet for the vast population of the U.S. going back to the 1990, 95? Can't even remember anymore. It's far easier and immensely cheaper than trying to subscribe to each one of these magazines or trying to chase down the latest or current copies at the library or wherever. You cannot live without the internet, particularly in doing this kind of program on electronic media. So here we have, and again, this article is entitled Netanyahu's Latest Falsehood. The United States didn't support the establishment of Israel. Benjamin Netanyahu's new campaign ad rewrites history. In a few weeks, Israel will be holding national elections. This will be at least the fourth or more consecutive occupation of the seat of prime minister by this one man, Benjamin Netanyahu. In a row, there was at least one term of his going back over 10 years ago as prime minister, and that was interrupted by one or two other people holding that seat, and then Netanyahu returned to power and pretty much has a bit of a one-man dynasty going here. Or you could say a dynasty of the Likud party, which is recognized, by and large, as the most right-wing political party ever in the seat of power in the Israeli government. So we have Netanyahu twisting, apparently according to Judas here, twisting the facts of history in order to Well, as he put it here, Ben-Gurion faces a crucial decision. Establishment of the State of Israel. The American Secretary of State strongly opposed. No, Judas points out that it was not a simple matter of the American Secretary of State opposing. And Ben-Gurion, contrary to the position of the American State Department, declares the establishment of the state. Where would we be today if Ben-Gurion hadn't done the right thing? And I think the inference here, I don't know if this is historically accurate or not, Ben-Gurion's political party either was the Likud 66, 67 years ago, or was a predecessory party to the present-day Likud. Only the Likud, only Netanyahu. He infers that he is something of an incarnation of Ben-Gurion in resisting, strongly resisting any inclinations of the Obama government, Barack Obama, who has shown far more guts than any other recent American president in facing Netanyahu down, even if by doing that he has not faced him directly, because of Israel's misdeeds and Netanyahu's misdeeds. Here we have the man who wants to continue to be Israel's extreme right-wing leader here. Basically saying, we're going to go our way and not the way of Obama, as though everything is strictly according to the dictates of the American president here, which obviously it is not. That says something about why Netanyahu is speaking to a Republican Congress tomorrow. Okay. Do you know how hard it is to push a push pin into even a cork board? Or, you know, plaster board when just the very tip of the pin is just a little askew, a little bent back? God, what a pain. One of life's true forms of torture. Okay, you are listening to the Mideast Migraine Show. I haven't said this in over an hour now. Mideast Migraines, the weekday edition, which comes to you every Monday at 3 p.m. here at Free Radio Santa Cruz, which broadcasts at a frequency of 101.3 on the FM dial. 101.3, and of course we have our streaming free of charge. From our end, anyway, free of charge, streaming online radio service at freakradio.org. That's freakradio.org, freakradio.org. If you're listening to us on your radio set right now, don't forget you have the option, if you have the appropriate device on hand, to listen to us streaming at you. You just got to go to our webpage and click on listen and then follow the instructions to make sure you can hear us. Don't forget to turn your speakers up and to have a proper audio reception device hooked into your system there. All right. Oh, I mentioned the fact that I do two programs, or I inferred strongly that I do two programs here. Of course, this one comes to you every Monday at 3 in the afternoon. The weekend edition of Mideast Migraines arrives at your electronic doorstep at 11 a.m. Pacific time, soon to be Pacific Daylight Time. We're going into daylight savings next weekend, from what I understand. But for the time being, it's just whether it's daylight savings or not, it's always Pacific time in the Pacific time zone that wraps around the entire world. 11 a.m. PT at 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. I am currently reading on the Saturday edition, which itself is dedicated to the reading of important books on the subject of Israel and Palestine, Semitism and anti-Semitism, stuff like that. I'm currently reading Anna Balzer's Witness in Palestine. The subtitle is An American Jewish Woman in the Occupied Territories, namely Anna Balzer. I'm well into the beginning of that book now. There have been two consecutive readings so far, so don't worry about missing anything, just tune in on Saturday, 11 a.m. Anyway, this is a riveting and, quite frankly, for me personally, very hard to read book, given the facts that I discuss concerning what Balzer herself has witnessed in terms of how the Israeli army and border police and, of course, those illegal Jewish settlers, the way those people treat the native Palestinian Arabs. So that's Saturday at 11 a.m. If you want to do any catching up to any of those readings or previous broadcast on the Monday edition, as I spoke about a bit ago today, go to radioforall.net. That's where my main archives are, where I store the recordings of the shows. That is a separate website, radio, the number 4, digital character 4, all.net. R-A-D-I-O, the number 4, A-L-L.net. Go to radioforall.net to do your catching up. You are invited to use, quote, replay any of those programs, as far as I'm concerned, and I think as far as Radio for All is concerned, to your purposes. But please do not abuse them. You can also go, by the way, to another website, Santa Cruz Indie Bay, I-N-D-Y-B-A-Y, Santa Cruz Indie Bay, Santa Cruz, I think it's full thing is called something like Santa Cruz Media Center Indie Bay, where I also leave recordings of my past programs. You can contact me, particularly noting the fact that no one has tried to call in today. You may contact me at this program's email address, MideastMadness@gmx.com. That's MideastMadness. At G as in George, M as in Michael, X as in xylophone.com. MideastMadness@gmx.com, and send a message to me that way. And it's 4:27 in the afternoon here. Earlier, I began relaying to people what I thought was a timely PSA announcement about an upcoming activity. Turns out, according to my information, this was held two nights ago on Saturday. But let me give you the basics about this. Even though the event itself is gone, this is a program which may be repeated by a woman named Dalit Baum. Dalit Baum, Jewish, of course. The title here is Hellfire, Lockheed Martin and the Weapons Industry Go to Gaza. She gave a talk 2 days ago, Saturday, at the Volombrosa Retreat Center in Menlo Park, California. This is what she talked about. A presentation by Dalit Baum. What is the role played by military industries in the Israeli siege and attacks, plural, attacks on Gaza by Lockheed Martin in particular? What does U.S. military aid to Israel actually support? This presentation contains new information about the new AFSC campaign in Jerusalem targeting the U.S.-Israel military-industrial complex. Probably we'll be hearing this phrase a lot more in the future, whereas President Eisenhower coined the industrial-military complex back in the 1950s. Now, Dalit, starting to talk about the U.S./Israel military-industrial complex. Now, that presentation at Menlo Park was part of the annual retreat of the Pacific Life community. I gather from this that she's prepared to repeat this presentation again. Dalit Baum, Ph.D., is the co-founder of Who Profits from the Occupation and of the Coalition of Women for Peace in Israel. Dalit is a feminist scholar and teacher who has been teaching about militarism and about the global economy from a feminist perspective in Israel and American universities. She has worked for American Friends Service Committee in the San Francisco office since 2013. An AFSCer there. And currently serves the organization as Director of Economic Activism. So, you can go to pacificlifecommunity.wordpress.com. pacificlifecommunity.wordpress.com for more information. Interestingly, that is the only internet address given here, but that really was as it pertained to her talk on last Saturday. But I get a strong impression by some of the responses to this announcement that people are interested in having her give that talk in Santa Cruz here, maybe, or perhaps wherever you are. Remember the name, Dalit Baum, D-A-L-I-T. Baum is B-A-U-M, the Hebrew word for tree, I believe. Dalit Baum. San Francisco Bay Area-based activist. Okay, and that's what that is. And you are listening to the Mideast Migraine Show with your host, Lawrence Wren Tawil. Your friendly local neighborhood Palestinian American. Destroying history. Now, this is from Popular Resistance, which is to say an internet outlet here, Popular Resistance. And it was authored, apparently, by Professor Mazin Koumsier, who teaches and does research at Bethlehem University, BU. Not to be confused with BYU. Bethlehem University and directs the BU's Cytogenetics Laboratory and the Palestine Museum of Natural History. And Institute of Biodiversity and Sustainability in Occupied Palestine. He also taught at Birzeit and Al-Quds Universities. He is the author of Sharing the Land of Canaan, Human Rights in the Israeli-Palestinian Struggle, Popular Resistance in Palestine, A History of Hope and Empowerment, Mammals of the Holy Land, and the Bats of Egypt. He formerly served on the board of the Palestinian Center for Rapprochement Between People in Beit Sahur, and Al-Rawad Cultural and Theater Society at Ida Refugee Camp, Professor Mazin Koumsier, dated March 1 on Destroying History. The actual title of the article is Destroying History. The Kingdom of, and he puts it in quotes, Saudi Arabia, is going to behead a man for, quote, apostasy, renouncing his belief in Islam and the Quran, while welcoming Egyptian al-Sisi, whose security forces are torturing people to death in Egypt, for being supportive of an Islamic political system more moderate than that of the kingdom. Meanwhile, the Egyptian kangaroo courts are declaring resistance movements outside of Egypt, who have little to do with Egypt, to be terrorist organizations. Sisi is also helping Israel enforce a siege on 1.6 million Palestinians. Now that is terrorism, he says here. The Jewish state in Israel and the Levant, or the JSIL, in the name of ancient mythologies, is using colonial settlers to kill natives, ethnically cleanse them, and torch churches and mosques with impunity. Mind you, he's not just talking about the Levant or JSIL, but the Jewish state in Israel. Meanwhile, their progeny ISIL loots their progeny, ISIL, loots and destroys priceless human heritage going back thousands of years. It started in 2003 when the United States invaded Iraq and its soldiers sacked Baghdad. U.S. soldiers were instructed to go and protect the ministries of oil and internal security, but allowed the pillaging, 15,000 priceless archaeological artifacts from Baghdad. At that time, I, Mazin Qumsiyeh, wrote the warning that the plan was to break up Iraq by encouraging sectarianism, until then unknown, and people living harmoniously for hundreds of years. Assyrian and Babylonian and Sumerian cultures were perhaps more civilized than our current, quote, civilization, based on monotheistic, quote, religions or on secular traditions. It is no wonder the remnants of those are being destroyed in Iraq in favor of the new idols, Netanyahu and Zionism. The Congress of the strongest military power on earth, the USA, funds regimes that commit Nazi-like atrocities around the world. Israel gets the lion's share of this, several billion annually. Netanyahu will try to justify genocide and ethnic cleansing of Palestinians and others. Republicans and some Democrats will listen to Netanyahu call for yet another war for Israel. Zionists push for the catastrophic war on Iraq and Syria, Mesopotamia, and now are pushing for an even more catastrophic war on Iran, ancient Persia. Persian history and archaeology may be destroyed like they are now doing for Mesopotamian history. Many of the Bible myths are taken from ancient Mesopotamian and Persian stories recounted 1,000 years before they were taken by the writers of the Bible / Torah. And then parenthetically here are the stories of Adam and Eve, Noah and the flood, Abraham and Sarah, Moses, and an, quote, Exodus. Many of the Bible myths are taken from ancient Mesopotamian and Persian stories recounted, actually says more than 1,000 years before they were taken, before those myths and stories were taken by the writers of the Bible, Torah. Perhaps the selective historiography, while destroying records of earlier periods of human history, is useful to those who want to use their religious narrative to rule. But it seems also useful for those secular people who want to advance hegemonic racist ideas. But it is not just history, but the fragile environment that is targeted. Perhaps the Obama administration is starting to see this, and maybe that is why they declassified a document showing how the U.S. helped Israel skirt international obligations and develop nuclear weapons. Maybe that is a first, and I hope that more documents would be released that show how previous administrations hurt U.S. interests to help the Israeli lobbyists get their way. From hiding the Israeli deliberate attack on the USS Liberty in 1967 to selling U.S. technologies to U.S. enemies to the Iran-Israel-Contra affair, etc. Hypocrisies and atrocities go on daily in this Middle East, thanks to all the weapons pouring in from countries that claim they want peace. The USA is the largest weapon exporter in the world, and most of it comes here, to the Middle East. Here is a novel idea if we want peace here: a total arms embargo on shipments of weapons to all countries in the Middle East. Israel, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Syria, and others. Spending 1% of that money, 1% of all that money on human needs instead of on promoting killing, would go a long way to reclaim our humanity. Here in occupied Palestine, we are trying on a small scale to resist. From the Friday demonstrations in several villages, This was the 10th anniversary, by the way, of the demonstration in Bilin, to trying to open Shuhada Street in Hebron, closed to punish Palestinians after, get this, Shuhada Street in Hebron was closed by the Jews, by the Jewish residents of Hebron, to punish Palestinians after a Jewish racist settler massacred dozens of Muslims, Palestinian Muslims, at the Ibrahimi Mosque. Somebody explain that to me. To Daily Sumud Stories, we are planting hundreds of trees weekly. To education and research, life goes on. That's the text of Professor Kumsi's article. But he notes here, he writes, note, please write to object to the environmentally devastating project to link the Red Sea to the Dead Sea, supposedly to save the Dead Sea. Frankly, this is the first I've heard of this, whose first $800 million stage was launched last week. So you've got the Red Sea on Israel's southwestern shore, or southwestern boundary, a narrow, the Gulf of Aqaba, as I recall. Wait a minute. I have the map of Israel or Palestine, whichever you prefer, in my mind here. Okay, Israel doesn't exactly have a long shoreline on the Red Sea. What it has is the ancient Arabic town of Aqaba, which is now called Eilat in Hebrew parlance, Israeli-Jewish Hebrew parlance, Eilat or Aqaba, on the southern tip of Israel, which is the exposure of the southern tip of Israel, Israel's exposure to the Red Sea in the tiny little Gulf of Aqaba there, the northern neck of the Red Sea. The Red Sea itself separates Africa from the Saudi Peninsula. So that's where the Red Sea is. And apparently the canal would start there in or just outside of Eilat, Aqaba, and run to the Dead Sea, which is technically the lowest point on Earth, although I think California's Mojave Desert, what's the name of that desert? Shame on me. Might be to compete with that designation. Maybe the Dead Sea is the lowest sea on Earth. At any rate, it is below the world sea level, the Dead Sea is. And it is also totally unpalatable water. You can die by getting just a little, swallowing just a little too much of it, if for no other reason, by choking to death in the massive amount of salt in the Dead Sea water. I guess Israel wants to, refurbish the Dead Sea, bring up the level, and possibly, make the water more palatable, make things safer. But as Kumsia writes here, this would be a devastating project, environmentally devastating project. Please write, he asked us to write to, object to the environmental devastating project to link the Dead Sea, the Red Sea to the Dead Sea, supposedly to save the Dead Sea, he says here. The first $800 million stage being launched last week. The Dead Sea was shrinking because of the Israeli diversion of the waters of the Jordan Valley starting in the 1950s. A catastrophic project within itself. The only way to fix that is to return the flow of the Jordan River to its pre-Zionist plan. He's speaking, of course, in environmentally, favoring environmental circumstances here. The Envision Project will destroy the coral reefs in the Gulf of Aqaba. The aforementioned Gulf of Aqaba, there are coral reefs there, and will devastate the fragile ecosystem of Wadi Araba. Go to electronicintifada.net/content / and these words all separated by dashes, how historic Israel-Jordan water deal leaves Palestinians high and dry. Electronicintifada.net/content/how historic Israel-Jordan water deal leaves Palestinians high and dry /13139 for all those with your pens and papers handy by your little radio sets there. Okay, it's just about 4:45 in the afternoon. Got to think about wrapping things up here. I try to say something every day in support, not only in support of this particular program, Mideast Migraines, in particular, but about free radio in general. Free Radio Santa Cruz has been operating without a license, without a federally granted legitimate license from the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, for 20 years now. In fact, 20 years this very month. We've been liberating the airwaves since 1995 and expect to continue to do it forever. We take this position not merely because it's a hell of a lot cheaper to avoid paying for licenses and other various services connected with other commercial radio outlets, but really the most important thing being is we want to remain free as possible from domineering corporate and governmental influences in terms of our editorial content, in terms of the music that we play, in terms of the message that we get across. As many of you can well imagine, there may be hell for me one of these days to pay for getting this message across to you on the radio and on the internet, on our streaming service. I may end up paying dearly for what I'm trying to do now. I've been able to get away with doing this for close to 3 years now. And I have only a very vague idea of repercussions that against my name out in public discourse that may have occurred. I've had, they have ranged from a single slamming hang-up call that I received here at the station a few months ago. I don't know what that person was trying to accomplish. Did he, male voice there on the other end when I did speak with him, did he believe he was going to intimidate me into discontinuing this service? I think not. Possibly to how I've been treated by the editorial staff at the Santa Cruz Sentinel, to others, other indicators out there. That there are people who are not happy with what I do here. The reason why I'm still on the air probably has a lot to do with the fact that, as is the case with virtually all of Free Radio's programs, I don't want to step any toes by admitting this, but it's not exactly a secret. We do not have a budget for promotional acts that we could commit to get people to listen to Free Radio more, and so for that reason it is strictly word of mouth, plus the message has gotten across by t-shirts and a few paper flyers and patches that have gone out in past years, like really limited advertising budget, right? So generally I can count the number of listeners on to my show anyway on let's just say on fewer than three hands, counting fingers there. Now that, of course, is only according to what I can tell on our internet program that scans and picks up the number of hits or the number of listeners who do tune into our online service. That is reflected, and that's not necessarily everyone who listens online. But this one service in particular indicates that there indeed is a minute community of people who listen, and I don't even know if it's the same three or four people, or whatever the number is, who tune in. It could be different people all the time. But that accounts for part of our internet audience. And then, of course, it's impossible for anyone to tell without very advanced electronic surveillance equipment how many people are tuning in just on their old-fashioned radios, on their little transistor boxes there. You know, I like to think that there are dozens of people, if not hundreds, who listen to us on the radio, the traditional radio set. So, anyway, who was I talking about? The thing is, I speak for this program as much as I speak for Free Radio Santa Cruz. Your listenerism, your listenership, your interactivity, preferably not only in terms of listening to us, but calling into shows, would be very much appreciated. And, of course, your money would be appreciated, quite frankly, even more, at least down to brass tacks. Face it, folks. We programmers, local programmers, local Santa Cruzians, or at least Santa Cruz Countyans here, are the ones who dish out the money to keep ourselves on the air. There are a few other donors, including regular donors, as in monthly, who care enough about this service, and we love each other mutually a whole lot. But the rest of the money does have to come from those who rely on this service, who know that we exist and appreciate the truly underground pirate grassroots character of this community radio service. We do ask for your donations. So grab that pencil and paper again. I'll give you yet another address for someone who puts the call out for donations. I mean, look, folks, even I'm buried by this stuff. I get mail at my house, too. Everyone is asking everyone for money. Well, I'm going to do it right now to you, dear listener. Please send even a small amount of money, and don't limit yourself to doing it just once. If you have it in your heart, please give either more than a little bit or give more often. To Free Radio Santa Cruz, simply write on the front of the envelope, FRSC, Post Office Box 7811, Santa Cruz, two words, S-A-N-T-A, Cruz is spelled C-R-U-Z, Santa Cruz, California, zip 95061. Pause. You ready now? Okay, let me give you that address once more. FRSC for Free Radio Santa Cruz. P.O. Box 7811. Santa Cruz. Ka 95061. Don't forget radioforall.net to get to the archives of my past shows. Or Santa Cruz Media Center Indie Bay for the same purpose. Please do not forget this program's email address, MideastMadness@gmx.com. MideastMadness@G, as in God, M as in me, X as in, I don't know, XYZ. MideastMadness@gmx.com. Now, okay, the show is about to turn off, and you'll hear from me next Monday at 3 p.m. Don't forget Anna Balzer's Witness in Palestine. I'll take up where I left off last Saturday. That's Saturday, 11 a.m. Thank you for listening. I'll hear from you again. You'll certainly hear from me again for a long time to come. Here is our very own, who else, Andrea Bocelli, singing the album title number, Romanza.
sento.
Today's Monday, March 2.
Già la sento morir. Però è calma, sembra voglia dormir. Poi con gli occhi lei mi viene a cercar. Poi si toglie anche l'ultimo velo, anche l'ultimo cielo, anche l'ultimo bacio. Forse colpa mia, forse colpa tua, è così, sono rimasto a pensare. Ma la vita cos'è? Tutto niente, forse neanche un perché. Con le mani lei mi viene a cercare, poi mi stringe lentamente, mi lascia lentamente, mi stringe lentamente, mi cerca. Sto a guardare, e lo chiamano amore, e lo chiamano amore, e lo chiamano amore, una spina nel cuore che non fa dolore. È un deserto questa gente con la sabbia in fondo al cuore. Tu che non mi senti più, non può più sentire, in silenzio se n'è andata a dormire, è già andata a dormire.